When we last saw Alexander Cohen, he was involved in the most convoluted of plots to foil the villainous Moriarty, see justice done, and produce a hit show. Remember?
So it's on with the case.
And there's no time to spare.
So it's up to the chase.
Oh, Miss Evans, take care.
Come what may, come what may, what a night is it going to be.
The Sherlock Holmes musical Baker Street, which opened on Broadway early in 1965, gave Alex Cohen a partial success, but the show never quite fulfilled the promises either of its subject matter or the hope and enthusiasm of its producer. And ever since then, the Cohen camp has felt that London has been missing something in not seeing Baker Street. And in the following year, there was another Cohen musical which got to Broadway and never reached Britain. Once again, the general feeling was that London audiences might have enjoyed the experience of judging for themselves, so that the effect has been for those two shows, the Sherlock Holmes musical and the one which followed it, to be bracketed together in the minds of both Alex Cohen and his wife.
The Time for Singing, which was a show which I admired a lot, was based on a beautiful property called How Green Was My Valley. It starred Tessie O'Shea, Lawrence Naismith, Ivor Emanuel, and Shaney Wallace. And it was a very delicate, loving, and tender piece. And I would also think that if I can find a couple of £100,000, that would go very well in the West End.
And it has a beautiful score. And one of the reasons that it was not terribly successful, because of the quantity of the score. There were like 30 songs in it. And we learned this later. One of the things that Rodgers and Hammerstein used to do so well was they would have maybe 15 songs, and you would hear them more than once. They would be reprised in the second act, and then by that time they were old friends. And so you did go out of a theater whistling a song because you'd heard it three or four times, and we overwhelmed them, or underwhelmed them, with the quantity of music, because How Green Was My Valley in the Welsh, it's a classic story.
Variety, May 25th, 1966. A Time for Singing is a curious musical. It is all in good taste, everyone involved is giving maximum effort, and there is not one bad or embarrassing moment. On the other hand, there is not a single stirring song, a rousing dance, or a moving scene. The Time for Singing doesn't create more than mild interest.
There's a time for laughing when the ways of the world seem absurd. There's a time for weeping when your grief can't be held in a word. There's a time for yelling when the pebbles of fate fill your shoes. But when the good cup of life runneth over and your rapture's the greatest you've known, you suddenly hear what others have heard. A moment like this has the sound of its own. Singing, sing out the joy that you feel inside. Sing out the smile that you cannot hide. This is a time for singing. Singing's a wonderful way to show all of the happiness that you know. You will find there are feelings that words can't say. Comes a time when a song is the only way. Joy of it, this is a time for singing. Fill up the air with a lovely sound. Tell all the world what your hearts have found. This is a time for singing. Floating a note as it thrills along.
This is a time for singing.
Oh, wake up the flowers and make them sing. Call up the voice of each living thing. Waves of song that are ringing the world around.
The world around.
Up they rise till the heavens then swell the sound.
Oh, the joy of it,
this is a time for singing. Send up your voice in a joyful phrase. Happy the hearts for these singing days. This is a time for singing. Let the whole world sing.
While A Time for Singing was on the stocks, the Cohen management was reviving a past formula which had bred success. Back in 1959, audiences at London's Fortune Theatre had been delighted and diverted by a tiny show which evoked nostalgic overtones of the old Victorian soiree.
I'm a ganoo. I'm a ganoo. The ganicest worker ganature in the zoo. I'm a ganoo. How do you do? You really ought to canoe wahoos wahoo. I'm a ganoo. Spelt G-N-U. I'm not a camel or a kangaroo. So let me introduce, I'm neither man or moose. So gano, 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 I'm a gano. I had taken furnished lodgings down at Rustington-on-Sea, whence I travelled on to Ashton-under-Lyme, it was actually. And the second night I stayed there, I was wakened from a dream, which I'll tell you all about some other time. Among the hunting trophies on the wall above my bed, stuffed and mounted, was a face I thought I knew. A bison. No, it wasn't a bison. And a carpet. Not much. Could it be a hearty beast? I seem to hear a voice. I'm a ganoo. I'm a ganoo. A another ganoo. I wish I could ganash my teeth at you. I'm a ganoo. How you do? You really ought to canoe wahoos, wahoo. I'm a ganoo, spelt G-N-U. Call me bison or a carpy and I'll sue. Ganor am I in the least like that dreadful hearty beast. Oh, ganoo, ganoo, ganoo. Ganoo, 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 I'm a ganoo. Ganoo, ganoo, ganoo. I'm a ganoo.
The drop of a hat with Michael Flanders and Donald Swann. Now, the beauty of that sort of thing is that if you can drop one hat, there's no reason why you shouldn't go on dropping more. And in 1966, 7 years and countless productions after the original dropping of the original hat, Alex Cohen induced Flanders and Swann to drop yet another one. Logically enough, that was exactly what they called it. The drop of another hat.
Was on a Monday morning, the gas man came to call. The gas tap wouldn't turn, I wasn't getting gas at all. He tore out all the skirting boards to try and find the main. And I had to call a carpenter to put them back again. Oh, it all makes work for the working man to do.
On the Tuesday morning, the carpenter came round. He hammered and he chiseled and he said,
"Look what I've found. Your joists are full of dry rot, but I'll put them all to rights."
Then he nailed right through a cable, and out went all the lights.
Makes work for the working man to do.
Was on a Wednesday morning, the electrician came. He called me Mr. Sanderson, which isn't quite the name. He couldn't reach the fuse box without standing on the bin.
And his foot went through a window, so I called the glazier in. Oh, it all makes work for the working man to do.
T'was on the Thursday morning, the glazier came along with his blowtorch and his putty and his merry glazier song. He put another pane in, it took no time at all.
But I had to get a painter in to come and paint the wall. Oh, it all makes work for the working man to do.
T'was on a Friday morning, the painter made a start
with undercoats
and overcoats.
He painted every part,
every nook and every cranny. But I found when he was gone, he painted over the gas tap and I couldn't turn it on.
Oh, for the working man to do.
On Saturday and Sunday, they do no work at all. So it was on the Monday morning that the gas man came to call.
Flanders and Swann giving the Alexander Cohen management another success, and also signalling the fact that experiments with full-scale large-cast musicals hadn't wooed Cohen away from his first theatrical love, the small show and the one-artist recital. In 1967, and again the following year, Cohen involved himself with someone who belonged in the same superstar class as Chevalier. As a matter of fact, she's been going almost as long as Chevalier.
honeybee, filled with jealousy. When they see you up with me, I don't blame them, you wouldn't know. Honeysuckle rose, when you're walking by, flowers from sight, and I know the reason why you're much sweeter than
The amazing Marlene Dietrich smuggling her beauty over the frontier of the 1960s by some secret method known only to her. Now, Cohen obviously relished the relationship because he renewed it in the following season of 1968.
But I would say that of all the artists that I've ever presented, surely Miss Dietrich ranks at the very top of the heap. She is the ultimate perfectionist. She is a really magnificent performer. She gives the audience five times their money's worth. It is a hell of a show, is what it is. When I presented her, it was in America on Broadway, and she had avoided Broadway for all her career. Marlena opened at the Lundfontein Theater, and it created quite a clamor in New York. Because it was a sellout engagement, and it was a fantastic success for her. She really is deserving of that on stage, because she does relate to stage audiences. She does know how to deal with an audience. She knows how to make them eat out of the palm of her hand, and she's comfortable in areas where she knows what she's doing, and very uncomfortable in other parts of the entertainment industry where she perhaps doesn't.
They call me Marcellella, the wife of Galen, and to my people so long, the place all is good. The boys all love my music, I can't keep them away, so my little piano keeps working night and day. They call me Marcellella, the wife of Galen, and to my people so long, the place all is good. Now I'll tell you a secret, don't have a hundred keys, for the opinion is always bound to be.
Lola, Lola, everybody knows me.
Ask the first man you see, he'll know where to find me.
Young men, old men, all fall into my nets. They all
The boys all love my music. I can't keep them away. So my little piano, he's working night and day. Oh, they call me Notchin Lola, the wisest gal on earth. And hold my piano, we play for its worth. Now I'll tell you a secret, don't have a 100 keys. The little piano's thimble was always bound to please.
Well, after Dietrich, what? 1969 saw Alexander Cohen tilting once again against the windmills of the full-blooded Broadway musical. Once again, the theme was borrowed from what you might loosely call literary sources, and once again, sadly, the adaptation lost something on the way. Having shown a singing Sherlock Holmes and a bunch of singing minors in A Time for Singing, the Cohen management now staged a musical version of the once highly successful melodrama by Girardot, The Mad Woman of Chaillot. Its title was Dear World, and its star, Angela Lansbury.
I came to the project late. Katharine Hepburn had been discussed for the role, and she chose not to play it on the theatre because she had made the movie. So I inherited it. It was not written for me. The songs were not composed for me. I think it is the finest musical work that Jerry Herman has done in the theatre, and I'm mad about the score. And so was Alex. He had great reverence for it. Because nobody appreciates talent more than Alex. I think he felt he had something super special.
One person can beat a drum and make enough noise for ten. One person can blow a horn, and that little boom and that little blare can make 100 others care. And one person can hold a torch and light up the sky again. And one little voice that's squeaking a song can make a million voices strong. If one person can beat a drum and one person can blow a horn, if one person can hold a torch, then one person can change the world.
There may be an army of them, only a handful of us, and how can a poor little band fight a mighty regime?
There may be a legion of them, and only a parcel of us, but it isn't the size of the fist, it's the size of the dream.
And beat the drum, and make enough noise for them. One can blow a horn, and that little boom, and that little blare can make a 100 others stare.
Person can beat a drum, and one person can blow a horn.
Then one can hold a voice, and one can change the world. There may be an army of them, and only a handful of us.
Do you
I think I possibly might have been a disservice to the show in that I came from a long run in MAME, and in that I had played a glamorous, almost contemporary woman. And in Dear World, I played an 84-year-old crone who was allowed by theatrical license to sing and dance and carry on in a fairly perky way. But nevertheless, I had a garish makeup on, and my clothes were filled with character and trappings, and there was no resemblance anywhere along the line to the lady that 6 months before they had seen cavorting around in MAME. So I think a great deal of the audience was taken aback and stopped in their tracks and felt as if they'd been cheated. So Alex really, in a sense, was the victim of his own star consciousness.
Variety, February 12, 1969. There are moments early in the show when the dynamic star, Angela Lansbury, establishes the character of the quixotic Daffy Countess Aurelia, and it seems as if she might be able to carry the production by herself, possibly even for the whole evening. But the leaden treatment of the Fay philosophic fable defeats her and thwarts even a receptive audience. Miss Lansbury is spectacular and is eloquent and captivating as she sings...
He stood and looked at me, and I was beautiful, for it was beautiful how he believed in me. His love was strong enough to make me anything, so I was everything he wanted me to be. But then he walked away and took my smile with him. And now the years blur by, but every now and then I stop and think of him and how he looked at me, and all at once I'm beautiful. Then he walked away and took my smile with him, and now the years blur by, but every now and then I stop and think of him and how he looked at me, and all I I'm beautiful again. For a moment, I'm beautiful again.
Well, that sounds very much better than the review in Variety would lead people to expect, but things weren't all so impressive with Dear World, which seems to have been plagued more than most productions and even more than most musicals with backstage hang-ups.
Dear World was the musical for which Angela Lansbury won the Tony Award. And although it ran a year and it had a glorious score by Jerry Herman, I never felt that it was a totally satisfying musical.
I think if he had used somebody who hadn't been associated with a previous hit of the caliber of Mame, he would have been better off. But it was not only his fault. I mean, after all, it was a decision that was arrived at in concert with the authors. Looking back, that's how I see it now.
Retrospectively, I realize the mistakes that I made, and I think Jerry Herman, who really shared the decisions with me, realizes the mistakes that he made. It would be nice if we could work together again on something else. But the only thing that emerged from Dear World was Angela's performance and Jerry's score, and the rest of it was clutter.
The show was in trouble even before we came to New York. It previewed for a great length of time in New York before we opened. When we finally did get open and running, we'd lost every penny that was put into it. It didn't make back a cent.
Apart from the financial side, Angela, what was your favorite song?
I Don't Want to Know, which I think is probably Jerry's best song to date. It was a Parisian French waltz, a frantic bid on her part to close her eyes and her ears to the fact that progress was ruining her beautiful Paris around her. It's a very moving song, I think.
If music is no longer lovely,
if laughter is no longer lilting, if lovers are no longer loving, then I don't want to know. If summer is no longer carefree, if children are no longer singing, if people are no longer happy, then I don't want to know. Let me hide every truth from my eyes with the back of my hand. Let me live in a world full of lies with my head in the sand. For my memories all are exciting, my memories all are enchanted, my memories burn in my head with a steady glow. So if my friends, if love is dead, I don't want to know. If music is no longer lovely, if laughter is no longer lilting, if lovers are no longer loving, then I don't want to know. If summer is no longer carefree, if children are no longer singing, if people are no longer happy, then I don't want to know. Let me hide every truth from my eyes with the back of my hand. Let me live in a world full of lies with my head in the sand. For my memories all are exciting, my memories all are enchanting, my memories burn in my head with a steady glow. So if my friends, if love is dead, I don't want to know.
The relationship in the musical theatre between Alexander Cohen and Angela Lansbury wasn't done with yet, as we shall see in a moment. But first, let's look at something very, very different in style and subject matter that Alex Cohen was responsible for bringing into London, even though it is reasonable to suppose that most of the locals who read about it didn't even know what the title was trying to say. Carol Channing puts it this way.
Alex Cohen brought 1776 to London, which was a big hit in this country. July the 4th, 1776, is our Independence Day. I have to explain that. Now, an Englishman came up to the box office. Alex was standing there and said, I would like a ticket for 1,776.
Well, a good story, but not such a good factual report. In fact, 1776 didn't do at all badly in London, considering that if Broadway had been faced with a musical called 1066, everyone would have been wondering what the significance of 1,066 was, and nobody would have bought a ticket at all. Now, one odd thing about 1776, eventually it was made into a movie, and in their own endearing way, the movie moguls managed to drop from the picture one of the best songs in the show. Fortunately, Alex Cohen didn't drop it from the London production, and nor did he drop this one, which is just as good.
Mama, hey mama, come lookin' for me. I'm here in the meadow by the red maple tree. Mama, hey mama, look sharp, here I be. Sharp. Them soldiers, they fired. Oh, ma, did we run? But then we turned wrong, and the battle begun. Then I went under. Hey,
Let us now return to the double act between Alexander Cohen in his attempts to produce a hit musical and the critics of Variety who kept explaining to him after the event where exactly he'd gone wrong. In 1971, Alex Cohen tried again with a show called Pretty Belle. And remembering that the last time Angela Lansbury had starred for him, she had won the Tony Award and very nearly sustained the production single-handed, not surprisingly, Alex went to her again. Again, she accepted the invitation to work for him.
Pretty Belle was a southern heroine, a lady from the southern United States who'd been the widow of a sheriff of the type that one read in the newspapers about during the times of the civil rights strife in the 60s, who was the kind of person who had Alsatian dogs, which he set onto the blacks in the south and hit them with hoses, etc. If I told you it was a comedy, you'd stretch your eyes and say, well, how can any musical dealing with that subject matter be a comedy?
Now, that's a very good question. And it's no surprise that Pretty Belle faded quietly into the limbo of hit shows that never were. But if we come forward to 1974, we find the Cohen management putting on an entertainment so pleasing that even Variety had to admit it. And yet again, Alex Cohen returned to the formula of his earliest successes, where he gambled on the personality of one artist and let that lone ego loose on an audience. In this case, the audience never had a chance, because the ego in question was one of the most enormous ever seen bulking over the horizon of Tin Pan Alley. Enter the larger-than-life Sammy Kahn, who describes Stage One.
It was a series of evenings staged at the 92nd Street YMHA, dealing with lyrics. And a different lyric writer took the stage on a Sunday and told of the trials and tribulations of writing lyrics. Now, most of these very, very marvelous and tremendously talented lyric writers, starting with Alan J. Lerner, Yip Harburg, Stephen Sondheim, the late and great Dorothy Fields, etc., etc., took the stage, and they were all accompanied by an incredibly good pianist called Richard Leonard, a Londoner. They were also embellished and aided by three singers. But most of these talented people made the evening kind of serious and lecture-like. When it came my turn, I took the stage and did what it is I do. I set myself up and had a marvelous time telling the stories of my songs. At the end of this two-hour discourse, the audience stood up. This reminds me of the old joke about the actor who was hammy, and he said, I had him in the aisles. And the fellow said, that's right, they were leaving. I said to the producer, I said, they're standing up, they're leaving. He said, no, they're not standing up to leave, they're standing up to give you a tremendous, tremendous ovation.
You see a pair of laughing eyes, and suddenly you're sighing a sighs. You're thinking nothing's wrong, you string along, boy, then snap. Those eyes, those sighs, they're part of the tender trap. You're hand in hand beneath of the trees, and soon there's music in the breeze. You're acting kind of smart until your heart just goes whack. Those trees that breeze, they're part of the tender trap. Some starry night when her kisses make you tingle, she'll hold you tight and you'll hate yourself for being single. Then all at once it seems so nice. The folks are throwing shoes and rice.
You hurry to a spot that's just a dot on the map. You wonder how it all came about. It's too late now, there's no getting out. You fell in love, and love is the tender trap.
Eventually, Sammy Kahn's recital is committed to tape, and eventually the tape falls into the hands of Alexander Cohen. And after that, Alexander Cohen falls into the hands of Sammy Kahn. Kahn gives the tape to Alex.
When I gave it to Alexander H. Cohen, I expected he would be rapturous, but 2 weeks went by, and all I heard was silence, and it really took me down a bit. And I said to myself, I guess that's what separates 92nd Street from 42nd Street. There's a difference between Uptown and Broadway. So I waited and waited, and one day the phone rang. It was Alexander H. Cohen to say, how would you like to have breakfast with me tomorrow morning? I said, look, we don't have to have breakfast for me to tell me that you don't like my show. He said, don't anticipate me. Just meet me at the coffee shop of the St. Regis Hotel. And so one early morning in 1972, I went to the St. Regis Hotel, and there sat Alexander H. Cohen. His opening lines to me were, you're opening on Broadway. Typically, I didn't take that as enough. I said, okay, but why didn't you call me for 2 weeks? I said, you know what you did to my ego in these last 2 weeks?
Well, that's an easy one to answer. Nothing has ever done anything to Sammy Kahn's ego except possibly to bolster it up a little more. Indeed, that's precisely where the charm of the man lies, and precisely why his one-man show was such a sensational success, artistically as well as commercially.
Came the day I walked into the scenery for the first time and did the lighting run through. And always Alexander H. Cohen sitting out front, almost kind of casual about it. And I guess after you've done as many shows as Alexander H. Cohen has done, you do become casual. But underneath the casualness, there is a great, great interest and a great, great cunning and a knowledge of theater. And his almost casual answers to what seem to be intricate questions only come from years and years in the theater. I'll never forget his attention to the fact that he didn't like the music stand on the stage. Now I wondered who was going to pay any attention to a music stand. It was good enough for me, good enough for everybody, but no, he persevered, and they kept bringing music stands in and out, and finally said, that's the one I want. I'm not sure if that stand didn't make the difference. And so it came to the opening preview, and I said to Alexander Cohen, I said, can you tell me something? He says, yes. I said, what's my cue? He said, what do you mean, what's your cue? I said, I'm the first one on the stage. No one is out there talking to say, and here he is, or gives me a cue line. He says, don't worry, you'll get your cue. And opening night of the first show, someone pushed me on the stage, which was Alexander H. Cohen's cue.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly away. Just what makes that little old ant? I think he'll move a rubber tree plant. Now anyone knows that an ant can't move a rubber tree plant, but he's got high hopes. He's got high hopes. He's got high apple pie in the sky hopes. Don't ever, ever ask me what Chicago means unless you've got an hour or two or three, 'cause it takes time to tell you what Chicago means, mainly what Chicago means to me. Gee, it's my kind of town. Chicago is my kind of town. Chicago is one town that will not let you down. It's my kind of town.
Well, came opening night, Alexander H. Cohn did all the things that are theater. He behaved like a totally theatrical professional. He sent the flowers, he sent the telegram, he came backstage in his dinner jacket, and he looked at me and says, "You all right?" I said, "I'm fine." I walked out on that stage opening night and did the show exactly as I've always done it. I guess I was too stupid to be frightened.
Perhaps we ought to cherish that remark of Sammy Kahn's, that astonishing remark, "I was too stupid to be frightened," because it's almost the only example in the whole world of false modesty on Sammy's part. In fact, he was shrewd enough and experienced enough and also talented enough to know that if only he could get at the audience, he would slay them to a man, which he did. In his autobiography, Kahn says that the best thing about writing songs is that you get a chance to sing them to whoever you're trying to sell them to. Well, with his one-man triumph, Kahn got all the opportunity he'd ever dreamed of to sing his own songs.
I stayed on Broadway for 6 months merely due to the great, great producer, Alexander H. Cohn. He called to tell me one day we are going to London. I said, "I would go to the moon with you." I came to London. Mr. Alexander H. Cohn was there. Again, his office is in a theatrical atmosphere. It's in the Queen's Theater on Shaftesbury Avenue. I took a little elevator again and went up to the fourth floor, and there he sat. And he says, "Well, how do you feel about London?" I said, "More important, how does London feel about me?"
Call me irresponsible, call me unreliable, throw in undependable too. Do my foolish alibis bore you? Well, I am not too clever, I just adore you. Call me unpredictable, tell me I'm impractical. Rainbows I'm inclined to pursue. Call me irresponsible, yes, I'm unreliable, but it's undeniably true. I'm irresponsibly mad for you.
Variety, April 24th, 1974. Sammy Kahn obviously revels in being a performer, an assignment at which he's well known in the trade, and lets the audience share his enjoyment. He doesn't even pretend to be a qualified vocalist, but gets by on enthusiasm and the help of a chest mic.
Well, the truth is that that doesn't quite do justice to the brilliant trick that Sammy Kahn pulled off for Cohen, and in a way, Cohen for Kahn. The "and then I wrote" formula worked so well that Kahn began to look like one of the most assured stand-up comics of his generation, when in fact he was a lyricist and nothing more. Another example of Cohen's acumen in picking the kind of talent that will sustain a one-man evening. But concurrent with the Sammy Kahn songbook episode, there was another of those full-blooded musicals that never quite made it, or at least never made it commercially. Variety reported that the London production of Applause lost about four-fifths of its $300,000 investment, but as an evening's entertainment, it met with the approval of most of the ticket buyers. Even Variety thought so.
November 22, 1972. Applause and its star, Lauren Bacall, have opened in London to hefty public and critical approval, and small wonder. Though not the musical of the century, it has a strong plot, dependable music, exciting terp routines, fine performances by the mostly British cast, and of course, Miss Bacall.
Who's that doll with the open-toed pumps? Would you kindly tell me, please? Look at her, Miss 1946. Teenage Margot, queen of the 40s flicks. Mella Rooney, who's that girl with the Maybelline eyes, acting like she knew the score? Ixnay, daddy-o, I never saw that girl before. Who's that girl with the permanent grin and the stockings with the seams? Did that kid with the caps on her teeth launch a million GI's dreams? Where is she, that girl of yesterday? With her falsies leading Lou Ayres astray. Boogie woogie baby, who's that girl with the chic shoulder pads? Could it be that long ago? No siree, Ariakisaki, she isn't anyone I know. Watch her dance, you can tell that she's hep, cause she digs that jump and jive. Wind her up, and she really can't act. You would swear that she's alive. How she smokes those brand new filter tips. Watch her pucker, those red hot tangy lips. Hey, bobbery bop, who's that girl in the platform heels? Who could that tomato be? That snappy chick, fly die, fly die. Trucking on down Tuxedo Junction.
The pink side suit
and the upswept hair. Boogie woogie bugle boy from Company B. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Me, hubba hubba.
But despite the applause for applause and the approval of public and critics alike, the show didn't prove the good investment that it must have once looked. In America, it had indeed been highly profitable, but in Britain, it failed. Well, at least financially. And that suggests that there is a profound difference between the two countries, at least on some levels. And who better than Alexander Cohen, who operates on both sides of the Atlantic, to explain those differences?
London is probably a nicer atmosphere in which to work these days, but I think that the fundamental difference is that all the people in the American theater paid adequately, or more than adequately, for their work, and I'm not quite sure that the same is true in England. I've always been surprised at the salaries that the artists accept. I appreciate that I'm a foreigner speaking and talking about an economy which I may not completely understand, but it does seem to me that some of the artisans in the theater in England are unfairly compensated for the contribution they make.
Brave words from a manager who works in this country, but Cohen has always taken that kind of an interest in the theater. An interest in how shows come about, why people want to be in them, how best to cater for the miracle of talent, and how best to make the public aware of its existence. Rady Harris mentions one aspect of this breadth of interest which has made Cohen renowned in the profession.
He is considered one of our most important and exciting producers, capped particularly by his annual production of the Antoinette Perry Awards, which he produces and has brought great distinction to the theater because they are, to the theater, what the Oscars are to Hollywood.
One of the performers who understands the importance of this aspect of Alex Cohen's career is Gwen Verdon.
He took over the presentation of the awards. Sometimes they would be done at a luncheon, and it was not even as important as getting a high school diploma. It's a great tribute to an actor or a director or the writer, and they were never done very well. They were never very interesting, and yet the people receiving them are these extraordinary people. So he took over the presentation of the awards so that you would be entertained, you would see the people receiving them, and it would have a kind of theatricality to it, which is what they're presented for in the first place.
So what are the dominant characteristics of Alexander Cohen, who's been producing all kinds of shows in all kinds of situations for more than 30 years? First, and obviously, his resilience. His wife, Hildy Parks.
He has a marvelous ability to rise above a situation that didn't work. I mean, there are a lot of people I know who have a play that failed, if you will, who 6 months later are still talking about it. And Alex is the next morning back at his office opening the page of the next script or getting on to the next project.
What does his assistant, Esther Charkham, think about him?
He's a very generous man, and it's very exciting to work for him. He gets intolerant of inefficiency, but that's because he's used to America and all the time-saving and efficiency machines one has to run an office there. He usually arrives in from New York on a night flight, not having slept all night, comes into the office not as early as he does in New York. His lifestyle is different from New York. New York, he's in at 8 o'clock. Here he waits till about 9:30, which I'm very thankful for. and it's just one phone call after another, non-stop, meetings and appointments. He never seems to suffer from jet lag at all, which I don't understand. Never tired. And he's just constantly on the go, with ideas and people to see and things to do, places to go in the words of the song. Everything's quick. The ideas come quickly.
Then there's the view of the people who perform for him, expressed most eloquently and yet most simply by Sammy Kahn.
If I had to vote for my number one producer, I'd have to give the nod to Mr. Alexander H. Cohen, because he is simply and merely a producer.
And finally, there's the man himself. What does he think about it?
The theater is my occupation, my profession, my avocation, my hobby. I live it, I breathe it. The minute you find yourself going home at night and turning off and not being involved in the theater, you might as well be out of it.
The American Showman was presented by Michael Craig, researched by Bill Sullivan, and written by Benny Green, who now has a few words to say by way of postscript and preview.
Well, some talk of Alexander, and some talk of entirely different Alexanders. As we say farewell to the impresario Alexander Cohen, remembering that among his most recent exploits has been a production of A Day in Hollywood, A Night in the Ukraine, we delve back into the dim past for one of his most successful predecessors, Alexander Ahrens. To be perfectly accurate, Alex Ahrens, who bulks large in next week's programme, was only half a showman. His achievements were done in harness with a partner called Vinton Friedley, who holds the curious distinction of having the oddest Christian name of any of the great Broadway figures. I don't know where you can get a name like Vinton from, but just as its owner was half a showman, so the name Vinton won half of immortality, as we'll hear next week. There are two undeniable truths that come out about Aarons and Friedley. One is that they were as unlike as chalk and cheese. People sometimes say that Gilbert and Sullivan was a marriage of opposites, but they never heard about Aarons and Friedley. Aarons was a quiet, fairly modest, rather studious chap who was crazy about good music and knew it when he heard it. Friedley was a bit of a dapper dan, a man about town, a slick operator, and, to judge from the evidence, not all that particular when it came to cutting corners. While Aarons led the sober life, Friedley knew what it was to dance to the staccato rhythms of the Ritz server's knock. The other thing about this comically ill-assorted pair is that they were responsible for the introduction onto the Broadway stage of music that America has never forgotten.
Oh, sweet and lovely lady, be good. Oh, lady, be good to me. I am so awfully misunderstood. So, lady, be good to me. Oh, please have some pity. I'm all alone in this big city. I tell you, I'm just a lonesome babe in the wood. Oh, lady, be good to me.
That was the title song of the first show that Aarons and Friedley ever produced in 1924. It was the first in other ways, the first big musical comedy to establish Fred and Adele Astaire as real stars, the first also to introduce the Gershwin brothers, George and Ira, as partners in a musical comedy. In fact, the links between the Astaires, the Gershwins and their producers were strong and less like a business arrangement than a social club. Alex had a sister called Ruth, who was younger than all of them, and remembered afterwards how piquant it was to brush with greatness in the course of her daily life. She was a bit too young to know what was going on at the time, but in retrospect she realised that she was a kind of walking footnote to the history of popular music in America.
My recollections of Gershwin, I remember clearly that he was a quiet, nice man. He seemed to be very charming, as I recall. He always had a big cigar, and he would be working what I learned later when I grew up, were the scores for these shows, for all of these songs that we now sing.
Aarons and Friedley produced several Gershwin shows, including at least one flop. The Great Depression depressed them so badly that the partnership broke up. Aarons went west and discovered Robert Taylor. Friedley stayed put and began producing again, very successfully, with Cole Porter. So between them, these two men, the city slicker and the bookish idealist, did some great things. Next week, Nanette Fabray and Ray Bolger and Ginger Rogers and Guy Bolton will tell the story, and the singing of people like Ella Fitzgerald, Ethel Waters, Mary Martin and Sarah Vaughan will show what good taste the partners had. And we'll also hear about the peculiar way that Aarons and Friedley guaranteed their own immortality by building a theatre and calling it the Alvin. And that doesn't take too much working out now, does it?
Benny Green was talking about next week's pair of American showmen.